In Nepal today, anger over a government ban on social media. Police in Kathmandu opened fire on protesters in a rare display of violence.
Why did the government respond in that way? Did they really have to shoot the bullets?
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We will have the latest from Nepal. Also, how a deadly attack against Israelis today could impact ceasefire talks for Gaza.
Anytime you have terrorist attacks like this inside of Israel that kill Israelis, Israelis become a lot more hawkish on the question of security.
Plus, Ethiopia celebrates the opening of a massive hydroelectric dam. Some of its downstream neighbors are not happy.
As long as we don't have a framework that regulates how these dams will operate, other countries have a lot to lose.
And for the greatest comics store on earth, head to Madrid. That's today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. In Nepal, huge protests of mostly young people erupted in the capital, Kathmandu, this morning after the government banned social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Police opened fire on protesters in Kathmandu, killing at least 17 people, according to Nepali officials. The United Nations called for a prompt investigation into the incident.
Rajneesh Bhandari was at the scene of those protests earlier today.
I was just in front of the hospital where there were dead bodies. I could see the relatives crying and then waiting for the bodies to be taken from there. I could also see the protesters were throwing stones at some of the police vehicles out there. There's one vehicle that was burned.
Bhandari is the founder of the Nepal Investigative Multimedia Journalism Network. We spoke earlier, and he says those protests are about more than the ban on social media.
The number of youths gathered was quite surprising to see them interested in politics and also to stop corruption in the country. You know, they were shouting slogans like end corruption, end nepotism, and all those things. And somewhere around midday, they were able to cross the barricade that was put by the police out there. And some of them did enter the premise of the parliament, especially near the walls and things. And then that's when the protests turned violent today, and the police started firing the tear gas, and then slowly some dispersed, and then there were the bullets being fired out there.
Is that when you decided to leave?
I decided to just come a little bit further from there, and then, but still, I've been in Nepal and then covering Nepal, you know, for the last 20 years. I covered the moment that overthrew a monarchy in the country.
And the monarchy in Nepal, that ended in 2008, correct?
Yes. And after this, I think this was one of the most intense protests I've ever covered in Nepal. So yeah, it was very, very intense and it was very violent as well.
Yeah, so the spark of the protests is the ban, but you said the young people protesting, they're angry with corruption. Have there been big stories of corruption in the current government?
What they have been saying on social media, there's something that's trending in Nepal is Nepo babies. That means there's a lot of nepotism in the country, and the children of political parties are getting a lot of benefits, and the politicians are actually getting paid from the taxes paid by the people. So this has been the main region. Another region where the youths are frustrated is because of the lack of opportunities. Mm. As you know, Marco, like every day, 2,000 people leave Nepal for jobs outside the country. Every day, that's every day. So that means what the youths are demanding or they want wanting is more jobs, more opportunities in the country so they don't have to leave the country.
Yeah, and if there's concern about Nepo babies, that plays into youth concerns over where they're going to get those jobs. They might be getting taken away from them. Is the government worried that social media is a tool by which this nepotism among officials and their families will be made known?
What I've been seeing is the government is very careful with the social media. Nepal banned TikTok a couple of months back, and then they had some negotiation, and the TikTok is back. TikTok and Viber are operating, and other platforms are banned. So the governments, I think they want to, in a way, regulate it, but also in one way, what it seems is they want to also control some of the algorithms that the social media have. So maybe that's one of the reasons why they want to have a point of contact of all the social media platforms in Nepal, and then also have some of the algorithms on their side. That could be some of the reasons why they want to, you know, regulate, and that's how they want to regulate.
Can you elaborate on that? Because TikTok, as you said, did register, is one of now the few apps that have not been banned in Nepal. So has registered with the government in Kathmandu.
It looks like TikTok has their representative in Nepal, but all the social media platforms don't have at the moment. And there seems to be some conversation between Facebook and the government of Nepal as well. And especially the, you know, information minister has been saying that, quote unquote, we tried our best to ask the Facebook and other companies to register in Nepal, but they were not willing to register in Nepal. And the minister was also saying that they were not willing to obey the, quote unquote, the constitution of Nepal. But it looks that the government is still, after this protest, after, you know, so many deaths of youths and students today, the government still want to regulate the social media sites.
Yes, for Facebook, now people in Nepal can't access it. How important is social media for Nepalis? How disruptive really is this ban?
It's quite disruptive, because if we look at the digital revolution in Nepal, it's actually quite surprising. Like, people did not use desktop, people did not use laptop, but they directly use mobile phones. And through mobile phones, they were using social media platforms. And something that they use first is definitely Facebook or YouTube. That has been the source of news, source of information. And most importantly, it's not just about news. It's all about connecting with the family members abroad, right? So if the family member is in remote part of Nepal and they have their son or daughter abroad, and Messenger has been a kind of connection for them with the family members. And ban, I think it has impacted a lot of people, especially people who are living in remote areas. And the second thing is, like, a lot of, like, businesses are based on the social media apps. They sell the products, they advertise it. Some people also monetize their videos, they're also earning. So everything is being affected because of the ban, Marco.
It was something you mentioned a moment ago. Many Nepalis are leaving the country. So between the people who are disconnected in rural areas and the people leaving the country, how has all of this impacted the ability of Nepalis to communicate with family overseas and vice versa?
True. It has been affecting them. And I think that's one of the frustrations that we saw today at the strait.
So what comes next for Nepal after today's deadly protest in Kathmandu? What are your concerns?
Yeah, it's quite difficult to predict at the moment, Marco, and what will happen tomorrow. And the saddest part is the life lost today. These youths, these kids, they want the country to put in the right direction. I think this innocent life lost, which is the greatest tragedy today, Marco.
Rajneesh Bhandari is the founder of the Nepal Investigative Multimedia Journalism Network. He spoke with us from Kathmandu. Since we spoke, news outlets in India have reported that Nepal has lifted the ban on social media apps in the country.
We all know that the chicken had to cross the road. Our question today is not why, sorry, no punchline here, but at what cost? This is a serious question for many kinds of animals. Without the right infrastructure, they can't reach the other side of the road at all. Instead, they become roadkill. Across the globe, there's a push to build more pathways specifically for wildlife, the world's Bianca Hillier reports.
When it comes to wildlife crossings, no two structures are exactly alike, says ecologist Tony Einfeld. He monitors a large network of them across Banff, Yoho, and Kootenai National Parks in Canada.
Different animals need a variety of different things. So some prefer underpasses, some prefer big open overpasses.
No matter the location, these crossings mostly bypass highways, train tracks, and other human-made structures. They can be pretty wide, up to about half the length of a football field, and cross more than 8 lanes of traffic.
Some of them have a lot of plants and trees and rocks and cover provided for the animals that might be a bit more wary.
The foliage and landscaping can help shield animals from car lights, for example.
And some are much more open and clear, so that they have a nice line of sight right across.
Another variable is how different animals approach the crossings. Some need no introduction to them, even trying to walk across before construction finishes. Others take a while to warm up.
When the crossing structures were totally new, it would take up to 8 years for bears to start learning how to use those structures.
The Canadian region that Einfeld covers has 48 crossing structures. 41 are under the ground, like tunnels, and 7 are overground bridges. It's one of the largest networks of wildlife crossings in the world. The very first ones were built in France in the 1950s. But the country at the vanguard of their development is the Netherlands.
By now, in the Netherlands alone, we have more than 80 wildlife bridges and a few thousand wildlife tunnels.
Edgar van der Grift is a senior researcher of animal ecology at the Wageningen University and Research Institute in the Netherlands. He says the country is able to set such a high bar because of a few factors. To start,
people do care a lot about nature here. People like to recreate in nature and they don't want to see it decline.
But perhaps most crucially, van der Grift says the people with power also see the benefit.
People in nature groups, but also people in the government. If you have committed people there and they really go for it, you get things done.
Experts say the lack of political will is a big part of what's preventing more wildlife crossings from being built around the world. In Costa Rica, Inez Asofefa has spent the past decade working for a group called Salve Monos. Her team has put up dozens of bridges to save howler monkeys from using power lines to cross roads.
One monkey a day receives a shock here in Costa Rica.
And her research shows that's a minimum, she adds. Unlike the bridges in Canada and the Netherlands, these bridges are made of rope. They're attached to tree branches, and they honestly look like monkey bars. Asofefa says a post-pandemic development boom has made them more necessary than ever.
A lot of building in these areas. And in all Pacific coast of Costa Rica, it's happened the same.
As more hotels and homes are built, there are fewer safe routes for monkeys to take. In 2022, Asofefa helped draft a bill that would make developers put up new animal crossings as they go. But the bill has not progressed through the government. In the UK, political will is also lacking.
We're just so far behind, and we should be able to do it. This is not an engineering, a technological, or even a space issue.
Martin de Retueto leads nature recovery at the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust. He says the economy is often prioritized by politicians, but he's quick to remind them
that the economy is very much underpinned by a healthy environment, and you need to invest in the environment as much as you do in any other type of the economy.
He adds that National Highways, the agency responsible for the country's motorways, is starting to address the issue more than they have before. Construction is currently underway for the UK's largest wildlife bridge in the Cotswolds. It's expected to be ready for animals like deer, badgers, and voles by the end of 2027. The impacts of climate change are also increasing the need for more wildlife structures. According to Per Sandström, an associate professor at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences, he works with the Sami people, Sweden's indigenous population, and reindeer herders to help identify the best locations for new reindeer bridges.
Building this is a way to brace for climate change. Because with the changing climate, the reindeer need more and more alternatives during different snow conditions.
The past 2 years in particular have proven this, he adds, when exceptionally large amounts of snow and ice forced reindeer to seek out other areas.
There is no question about the need of accessing these lands.
Sweden's public broadcaster reports that the country's transport agency plans to build up to a dozen new reindeer crossings over the coming years. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Just ahead, the opening of a new hydroelectric dam in Ethiopia is inspiring feelings of national pride. Construction began back in 2011, but blocking the flow of the ancient Nile River has led to tensions downstream with the government in Egypt. Stay tuned. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Ethiopia is celebrating the official opening of Africa's largest hydroelectric plant this week. It's part of a massive infrastructure project on the Nile River, many years in the making.
The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is meant to boost the country's energy independence. It has also sparked serious tensions with Ethiopia's neighbors downstream, Egypt and Sudan.
Hanna Atiya is a research fellow at the German Institute for Global and Area Studies. She joined us from Cairo to explain why Ethiopia's northern neighbors are so concerned.
85% of the Nile waters that reach Egypt are generated from the Ethiopian highlands. So they are generated from the rain that happens in Ethiopia. It feeds off into the Nile and then it reaches Egypt.
Yes, so what does the inauguration of the dam mean for Egypt and Sudan, the downstream neighbors?
I mean, if we're looking at it from a technical perspective, the water share of both countries on an average day should not be affected by the GERD because it's a hydropower dam. The water is going to be used for electricity generation. It's going to get stored. But as long as Ethiopia would agree to reasonable and equitable flow of waters, the water can flow onwards to Sudan and to Egypt. The problem for Sudan and Egypt is more about a lack of treaty that has been made on the operation and the filling of the dam. So they are concerned that if a drought happens, because the dam is constructed and it's storing a lot of water, not enough water will be released to reach Sudan and Egypt.
Egypt in particular, the GERD is seen as an existential threat, more so than perhaps Sudan. You're currently in Egypt, Hanna. What are people saying there?
Of course, people are opposing the GERD, both on the governmental level, but also on the ordinary citizen. And this is not only the case in Egypt, but it's also the case in Ethiopia. So in Egypt, the Nile is where this Egyptian civilization started. We are a country that is facing a lot of water scarcity. So there is a lot of opposition there. In Ethiopia, it is very similar. What Ethiopia did was ask its own people to fund the construction of the dam. So a lot of people donated money. So it is a project that symbolizes their sovereignty, so to say, when it comes to water security, but also their nationalism, so to say.
What have been the major sticking points in these attempts at negotiations that have all fallen apart?
So Ethiopia perceives it as its right to build a dam. And it is their right to build a dam. The Blue Nile waters originate from there, so they have the right to utilize this water to generate electricity and so on. What they are not willing to do is to enter any agreement or any legal treaty kind of binding them to a certain operation of the dam. And I think a very big explanation to this is how historically Nile waters have been utilized by Egypt and by Sudan. Because for a very long time, they have been using up most of the Nile waters and preventing other countries from utilizing much of it. Egypt and Sudan keep on drawing back to historical treaties that have been made with Great Britain and also a bilateral treaty between Egypt and Sudan back in 1929 and in the 1950s, where Ethiopia was not even part of any of those treaties. So Ethiopia views these treaties as colonial treaties. It views these treaties as void. Whereas the other countries are saying, it's our historical right. We've been doing this for decades. You cannot come and unilaterally just change the share of Nile waters and how much we will be receiving.
So, Hanna, Ethiopia is moving ahead with the inauguration of this giant dam, regardless of the fact that there is no treaty in place. What does that mean going forward, though?
I think that means that tensions will mount, but we are still facing a deadlock. I think a potential or a window for reaching an agreement has long passed. That said, there is definitely a need for a Nile River Basin management framework, so to say, in order to coordinate but also solve cooperation problems like the one that these countries are facing right now. Because Ethiopia is not benefiting from the Nile alone. As said, it has a responsibility to other states such as Sudan and Egypt to ensure a fair use of Nile water, so to say. And as long as a framework for such cooperation is lacking, there is a lot of room for tension to mount, but also for disputes to happen. So there needs to be an effort towards reaching an agreement on the operation of the GERD, but also beyond the GERD, because the GERD is not the only dam that is currently in place, and it's not the only project that is currently running. In the future, a lot more dams are planned, especially by Ethiopia. So as long as we don't have a framework that kind of regulates how these dams will operate, other countries have a lot to lose.
Hannah Atiyah is with the German Institute for Global and Area Studies. She joined us from Cairo. In the opening credits to the 1980 movie American Gigolo, there's a convertible Mercedes cruising along the Pacific. The theme song by Blondie hit number one that year. The first person you see in the scene is Richard Gere, but you don't see his face, only his clothes. Attire made by an Italian designer barely known in the U.S. at the time, Giorgio Armani, whose death was announced a few days ago. Call Me was composed by another Italian, Giorgio Moroder. It was as if culturally American Gigolo was trumpeting the arrival of something new and exciting from Europe, not to mention a profound shift in men's fashion and maybe a prescient nod to 1980s excess.
Up until then, Hollywood's wardrobe departments thought of men's suits mostly as conservative, functional, drab. Something guys would wear to the office and not shake up the establishment. Armani shifted the thinking here to more relaxed designs in softer, muted shades. Still a power suit, but understated.
I think you're guilty of sin.
The cop trailing Richard Gere's character in the movie is the boring dresser showing what is passé. There's even a scene in the movie with Gere rifling through his closet, sorting through a bunch of Armani shirts, ties, and trousers.
He's deciding the best way to pair certain items in case you, too, wanted to master the way of Armani.
For many fashion historians, the age of Armani really began with that movie. American Gigolo director Paul Schrader told GQ magazine some years ago that John Travolta was originally going to play the title role and was all set to wear Armani clothes selected for the movie at the label's house in Milan.
But Travolta dropped out and Gere ended up with a part. Schrader said in that interview, "We kept all the Armani clothes. It was just a matter of tailoring."
As for Giorgio Armani himself, "American Gigolo marked a crucial milestone in my work," he once wrote. He said he watched the film several times over the years.
We'll be right back with more global stories. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. In Jerusalem today, two Palestinian gunmen shot and killed six people in an attack at a bus stop. It happened at a major intersection on a road leading to Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem. The two assailants were shot by an Israeli soldier and a civilian, both of whom were at the scene.
The war in Gaza has sparked a surge of violence in Israel and the occupied West Bank, with a rise in attacks by Palestinian militants and settler violence against Palestinians. Hamas hailed today's attack without claiming responsibility, calling it a, quote, natural response to the occupation's crimes against our people. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today's violence is another indication of Israel's continued fight against terrorism inside and outside the country. The world's Shirin Jafari has been following this and spoke with me earlier today.
The attack happened around 10 a.m. in a major intersection. The videos posted online showed people waiting at a crowded bus stop, and then suddenly you hear the sound of gunfire. People panic, some run. And then I saw this video in which a taxi driver gets out of his car and then starts running. But then he comes back to help his passenger. As she gets out of the car, you see that she's an older woman and she's walking with a walking stick or cane. Israeli officials have said several other people have been injured in the attack and that both of the attackers were killed on the scene by armed people who were among the crowd.
So, of course, this all happens against the backdrop of the war happening in Gaza. How do today's attacks impact ongoing negotiations between Israel and Hamas?
Negotiations have been on and off for a long time, Carolyn. Hamas says it wants a complete end to the war and the release of the Palestinians that Israel holds in its prisons. There are thousands of them. And then Israel says Hamas should disarm and surrender, something that Hamas doesn't want to do. Yesterday, President Trump issued an ultimatum to Hamas leaders on social media. He said, quote, end this. This is my last warning. I spoke with Aaron David Miller with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and I asked him how he sees these negotiations and the impact of this attack on these negotiations. Miller is a former diplomat and an advisor for Israeli-Arab negotiations.
I think an already fraught negotiation has been made even more tenuous and uncertain by today's developments in Jerusalem.
Miller says Trump doesn't have many options to enforce his own warnings.
We could, of course, withdraw or suspend or cancel any further American participation in these negotiations. But by and large, I think the threat he is wielding would be delivered by Israel's continued military operations against Gaza City and areas further south.
So people in Israel have been demanding an end to this war and the return of the hostages. The government, of course, has not ended the war. What are you hearing on that front?
Yes, so we've been seeing ongoing protests in Israel with people asking that the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, prioritize the return of the remaining hostages. But his far-right coalition has threatened to quit if he ends the war before Hamas surrenders. And he has called on the military to intensify its attacks in Gaza and start a new operation to take over Gaza City. I asked Michael Kaplow about the mood in Israel regarding the war in Gaza. He's with the Israel Policy Forum in Washington.
There's a huge amount of pressure on Israeli reservists, and many of them have been issued new call-up orders for the fourth, fifth, or sixth time since the October 7th attacks. There's also real concern about what this operation will mean for the fate of the 48 Israeli hostages, 20 of whom are still alive, who are still being held by Hamas.
And he says there are concerns, obviously, about the level of death and destruction in Gaza. As for the question of how today's events can influence discussions within Israel about security, here's what Kaplow told me.
Anytime you have terrorist attacks like this inside of Israel that kill Israelis, Israelis become a lot more hawkish on the question of security.
As I said, this is all happening as the war in Gaza continues. What is the latest news there?
Yes, Gaza City has been under heavy bombardment, and at least 40 people have been killed today. You know, we hear about people being killed inside Gaza in Israeli attacks basically on a daily basis. The Israeli forces have been dropping leaflets and warning people to move to other locations, but people say other locations inside Gaza are not safe either. The military has also been destroying several high-rise buildings that it says Hamas uses. And people on the ground say these are commercial and residential buildings. So, you know, the fighting continues in Gaza with heavy toll on the residents, and the negotiations to end this war seem to be hanging in the balance at this moment.
The world's Shireen Jafari, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yusuf Swed has spent the past 2 years trying to avoid discussing the October 7th Hamas attacks and Israel's war in Gaza. But now the Palestinian-Israeli actor based in Berlin has a sold-out show grappling with what it all means. It's called Between the River and the Sea. It's about identity, belonging, divorce, and conversations that are almost impossible to avoid. Reporter Rebecca Rossman has more.
I am not going to talk about the war. I am going to talk about my divorce.
Divorce is the entry point to this story.
What can I say? After 10 years, my wife had enough of me, of the relationship, of Berlin. She didn't really connect with the cold and the people. Not the cold weather, the cold people, but also the weather. You know what I mean.
But politics, identity, and family quickly slip in. Between the River and the Sea traces a lifetime caught living in between, between cultures, families, histories. Like here, imitating his father, Sliman.
You are not an Israeli Palestinian. You are a Palestinian with an Israeli passport. This is a very important subject, Yusuf. You have to be very precise with your definitions.
Born in Haifa to Palestinian Christian parents, Swed converses effortlessly in Hebrew and Arabic, shape-shifting between multiple identities across the hour-long show. I met up with him at a cafe during the show's limited run at the Edinburgh Fringe, where he told me he spent his whole life feeling like a bridge between communities.
We are the ones who are between the river and the sea, and that's how I felt my whole life, being an Arab, living in Israel, among Jews, being Christian, among Arabs, among a lot of Muslims.
But being the bridge means being caught in the middle with family, friends, all with expectations, voices demanding he choose a side. Isabella Sedlec, Swed's longtime collaborator, co-wrote and directed the show.
We have this scene also where Yusuf speaks on the phone to his two friends, like one who's Palestinian and the other one who is Jewish-Israeli.
Why don't you show the world the horrible things they did? Why don't you post anything? What do you want me to post? There is no hope, run.
And sometimes people ask us, like, but who is talking when? Then it gets confusing. And this was kind of part of what we wanted to reach, because, like, at one point they kind of start to say the same things.
I'm going to 3 funerals every single day. Do you understand? I want the dead, all dead. I'm sorry, it's time for war now.
Even personal life is infiltrated by this us versus them mentality. Swed shows how easily the lines blur between the stakes of his divorce and the bigger conflict.
My fight in the show is who's going to get the children, like where should they live? And it's a fight for the children to stay with us and to be safe. And for some people, to make the children safe is to go for a war.
When Swed divorced his second wife, she moved back to Israel. He's now raising 2 Jewish-Arab children in Berlin, trying to give them a world where identity isn't a weapon. The custody battle mirrors the tug of war he sees in broader political conflicts. As the show unfolds, Swed turns from his own story to the people around him, like the school bully from his childhood, a kid named Avi.
Because he was hurt by his father, he wants to hurt others. It's not because he's Jewish, it's not because he's Palestinian or whatever.
In other words, what we often mistake as identity, Israeli or Palestinian, Jewish or Arab, is sometimes just pain handed down, generation to generation. The show is shaped by a series of personal interviews Sedlak had with Swed, finding humor, grief, and insight in the middle of life's messy truths.
He always talked about October 7th, of course, about the situation right now, and then he said, but I don't want to talk about it. So then I always said, so what do you want to talk about? And then the divorce, the kids.
Raised in a bubble where taking sides was almost mandatory, I asked Swed how he managed to see beyond that.
I didn't care about identity. I feel, again, that I was forced to choose a side, to choose an identity. And for me, like, what? I don't understand why people... Why is it so important?
When it comes to raising his two young kids, Swed says he spent a lot of time avoiding conversations about identity. But he admits his teenage son recently came to him asking questions.
What's happening in the Middle East? What's happening in our homeland? And then I have to answer.
But Swed knows answers don't mean dividing people into good or evil. The reasons behind our choices are messy, shaped by upbringing, circumstance, and desire for peace. With his son and in the show, he doesn't resolve these contradictions. He leaves us sitting with them. It's not always satisfying, but it is real life. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Edinburgh.
Between the River and the Sea continues its sold-out run at the Maxim Gorky Theater in Berlin through the end of September.
And now a few updates on stories we are following from across the globe.
In Pakistan, more than 25,000 people have evacuated from Jalalpur Pirwala because of floods. The city is in eastern Punjab province. The evacuations come 2 days after a rescue boat capsized in floodwaters nearby, killing five people. Monsoon flooding has driven more than 2 million Punjabis from their homes since the end of August.
In Australia, Erin Patterson has been sentenced to life in prison for poisoning four of her estranged husband's relatives with death cap mushrooms. Three of those people died as a result. According to the sentence handed down today, Patterson will be eligible for parole in November 2056, when she will be 82 years old.
And South Korea's Foreign Minister Cho Hyun is headed to the U.S. to finalize the return of several hundred South Korean workers back to their home country. They were detained last week at an electric vehicle battery factory operated by Hyundai and LG in Georgia. President Donald Trump has said those workers were in the U.S. illegally. We'll have more on that story tomorrow.
Fans of manga, the Japanese comics genre, consider this film a classic. The 1988 Japanese hit Akira is about a boy and a scientific experiment gone wrong. The movie helped fuel the manga craze in the West. It is also the name of and inspiration for a comics store in Madrid. It was just named the best in the world for a second time. The World's Jerry Haddon takes us inside Akira Comics.
The old adage, don't judge a book by its cover, it applies to comics too. And who'd have thunk it, to comics readers. The first person I approach inside Akira is a middle-aged mom. Her 9-year-old son is dragging her along by the hand. Could I ask the boy what comics he likes? I ask her. She laughs. I'm the comics fan, she says. I love graphic novels, says Nazaret Garcia, but I also like classic superhero comics. I go from one extreme to the other. Because you can in Akira Comics. It has everything from manga to the Marvel Universe to fantasy literature. Garcia says she only shops here, even though in Madrid there are several other comic stores. Because it's a fantasy land, she says. You become immersed in another world, or worlds, plural. Akira is like no other comic store on Earth, which is partly why it won Best on Earth at this year's Comic-Con in San Diego. Comic-Con is the biggest yearly comics industry gathering. Walk around the 9,000-square-foot Akira store, the largest in the world, and you'll soon find a life-size facade of a Hobbit house. It's a replica of Bilbo Baggins' place from The Lord of the Rings, round wooden door and all. Instead of using all of our wall space for comics books, says Akira co-owner Jesus Marugan, we decided to do something no business person in their right mind would do. That is, waste prime retail space on not-for-sale decorations. But since we're bona fide weirdos, he says proudly, we took the weird route. And actually, he says, when people saw the Hobbit house, they were like, whoa, what is that? And that's how it all started. Where it will end, Marugán has no idea. On a quick tour of Akira, I nearly trip over a to-scale replica of R2-D2, the beeping droid from Star Wars. Two of the columns holding up the store's second floor, once transformed into a magical glowing tree, the other the twisting green beanstalk a certain Jack once climbed. As for the upstairs, for the moment, it's cordoned off. The stairs are blocked right now, Marugán says, as we finish our European cathedral. For those unfamiliar with comics, he says, it's to let them know they're in the European section for sci-fi, fantasy, and steampunk literature. When done, the walls and ceiling up there will appear as vaulted stone arches, replete with gargoyles in the form of Yoda, the Star Wars Jedi Master, and Stitch, the Disney alien. But by far, Akira's largest section is devoted to Japanese manga. A street sign at the start of a long corridor reads Neo Tokyo District. The area is adorned with red Japanese lanterns. Our clients really like our style, the way we think, says Marugán. We put our soul into this place. We leave a trace of our essence in everything we do, he says. Clients recognize that, he says, and are drawn to the positive vibe, the helpful staff, and a selection of over 60,000 comics and books to browse through. For serious collectors like Madrid college student Alejandro Caraza, it's a place where rare gems appear. For example, he says, we just saw an exclusive limited edition of the Wolverine from Marvel's The X-Men. They're always getting new and rare stuff in. You need to be on the ball, he says, and get here fast. Otherwise, things sell out. As to getting here, it does take some effort. Akira Comics is located in Madrid's far north, and during the week, it only opens from 5 to 7:30 p.m. One woman complains to a clerk that she and her kid have been coming by day after day, only to find the store closed. Which might explain why, before opening, the sidewalk outside is filled with comics lovers waiting to get in. Among them, a young office worker named Maria Serrano, who traveled an hour and a half on the subway from the far south of the city. We came all this way just for this, she says. It's our third try. My boyfriend and I are creating a shelf at home to display all of our various Marvel Comics editions, and we hope to find more. And then Akira's doors open, and Serrano and the others rush inside, each into a world of their own choosing. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Madrid, Spain.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. As countries across the globe debate LGBTQ rights, this next story shows what the language in a single piece of legislation can mean to a family. Deb Van Slett is from Montreal, and she raised her daughter there in the 1990s and early 2000s. This is how she introduced herself when she appeared on Stories from the Stage here at GBH in Boston.
I am a lesbian mom.
Van Slett started her story by addressing something she says folks still often get hung up on, how she and her partner got pregnant.
People sometimes still like to ask me, how did you do that exactly?
There was a sperm donor named Michael. He was a friend who lived down the street. Deb's partner, Erica, carried the baby.
My job was to put the sperm into a needleless syringe, not a turkey baster, because they're way too big.
The whole thing, Van Slett says, was actually pretty easy. Here she is with the rest of her story.
Once you remove reproduction from the physical sex act, people think that it must necessarily be clinical and complicated, which sometimes it is, but not always. Dr. Mock is introduced to us as a lesbian-friendly doctor. It's more like he's non-judgmental and kind of indifferent, which for 1993 is fine. In the delivery room, Michael and I are there. And in classic fashion, Dr. Mock sweeps in at the end and catches our baby daughter. And he takes the scissors to cut the umbilical cord and he gives them over to Michael. I'm like, ah, jeez, you missed the story. But I look at Michael, and Michael looks at me, and I'm like, this is moving way too quickly, so go ahead. So he snips the cord, and it is beautiful. A few days later, Eric and I take our newborn baby daughter, August, home. It's summertime, and Erica is tired, so I put August into a sling, and I go out for a walk in the neighborhood. And I get so much attention. I am seen in a totally different way. People, strangers, want to peek inside the sling. I am interacting so much. And when I'm out with her alone, I am mom. When Erica and I are out together, it's different. People look at the baby, they look at us. Who's the mom? We both are. Some people react with, cool. Others are like confused and retreat. Still others push it a bit, like, well, okay, but who gave birth? Who's the real mom? The mid-1990s are early days for out lesbian motherhood. A birth mom, easy to understand. A non-birth mom, are you like the stepmom? Are you like an auntie? Or worse, are you a babysitter? Honestly, in the first few months, I felt more like a dad. Nothing physically had happened to my body. And the connection between a breastfeeding mother and child is really intense. And interestingly, a couple of my male friends who were having babies really wanted to talk to me about being a dad. The other thing in the mid-1990s was that there was a cultural shift in lesbian visibility. Dykes were so in. Ellen DeGeneres came out on primetime TV. Newsweek magazine had a cover article about lesbian life. And we were living quite an out life in Montreal. I was doing a radio show called Dykes on Mics. It is a very good name. And our little unit became the go-to family for media stories about kinship and chosen families and how do lesbians have children anyway? So on the one hand, there's all this visibility. On the other hand, there's still this legal invisibility. I'm a non-biological mom, so I can't really make any legal decisions about our daughter's education or healthcare. And even though Michael wasn't on the birth certificate, he still had more parental legal rights than I did. My biggest fear was that something would happen to Eric and I would have to rush August to the hospital, but I wouldn't really even be allowed to make any decisions or even be with her because I wasn't a legal parent. And I didn't think about that too much because these were the circumstances. I had to have trust. And this was put to the test when Eric and I split up when August was 3 years old. And on top of the personal pain was also the sense of failing. Failing our family, failing our community. We were model lesbian parents. We were pioneers. And it felt like we had to be twice as good to be as good as straight parents. And splitting up, we had to do that three times better than anyone else. In 2002, in Quebec, August is 8 years old. And there's a major turning point in the fight for queer rights. Same-sex civil unions are legally recognized, and legislation to protect the rights of non-biological parents. The law saw me and said, you too are a mother. Within 2 months, we were holding in our hands a revolutionary legal document, a birth certificate with two mothers listed as the legal parents. My name was on the birth certificate. We may have been living an out life in our queer community, but having a kid means coming out over and over again in all these straight places. Daycare, schools, clinics, the playground. Did this legal document make me feel a little braver about coming out during a parent-teacher interview? Yeah, it did. a law doesn't mean that you're immune from people's discrimination or judgment, but this really mattered. This mattered to us. This mattered to me. I needed my name on that birth certificate, and I'll never take that for granted. Thank you.
That was Deb Vancelette of Montreal. Over the summer, she shared that perspective about Canada's LGBTQ history on Stories from the Stage, produced by GBH in Boston.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston.
And from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. Also, find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll be right back here with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PR.